What I'm excited about this time is going through Daniel chapter 11, but I'm going to approach it a different way, only because I'm still growing in my understanding with Daniel 11. It has never been a chapter that has really inspired me. I've never loved this chapter, and so I haven't presented it for actually about 24 years now. When I first became a Christian, I had a series on the book of Daniel, and I went through, at the time it was Mark Finley's messages, and I just basically rehashed what he had said. But since then, I haven't really addressed it. I've studied it over and over again with many different people, and I've gone through it many times myself, but I've never found it as a chapter I've loved. Now, I'm going through it this time in a way that shows and proves that I've been able to learn a little bit more about it, but I'm not going to interpret the chapter of Daniel 11. What I'm going to do is go through and give reasons why I have now concluded that the chapter is not symbolic from verse 1 all the way to 45, but rather it is to be understood as literal. Now, I can see that now, having many years before argued that the end, the last verses, are symbolic. Well, you know, I have also argued that all roads lead to Rome. And that is true. You can see it in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, even Daniel 9. You can see it in Revelation 13 and 17. But then you get to Daniel 11 and it's like, but it leads to Turkey, right? So I've always had a concern about that. But then now I recognize all roads do lead to Rome. And for example, just in case somebody doesn't want to listen to the rest of the message, they can at least hear this part. What you might be interested in is that I've kind of concluded in verse 45, just so that, you know, people can get the meat of it without having to go through this whole hour-long presentation. The King of the North comes to its end in verse 45. And so if Rome, the papacy, has any part at all to play at the end of time, connected with America, who's already got his hand stretched over into the Holy Mountain over there, if you will, what used to be considered the Holy Mountain, then we can see how the papacy comes in and brings that King of the North to its end. And if that's true, then certainly all roads do lead to Rome. Okay, so, but all roads lead to Rome through the path of, you could say, Asia Minor, right? So what we're going to do here is, instead of interpret the chapter, I'm just going to go through and show you why I have concluded that this chapter is to be understood as literal. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen, and you, like I said, if you have questions, please feel free to write them down. You probably have plenty of comments about Daniel 11, because many people will say I have the truth and many other people will say I have the truth. I frankly do not mind if somebody has a different understanding than I do about Daniel 11. It frankly doesn't bother me a bit. Now, what does bother me is if somebody feels as though they have like the latter rain message because they understand Daniel 11 a certain way. I'm not like that. I don't have that same passion about Daniel 11. So if you do, and if you want to take your thoughts somewhere else, then go for it. But as far as I'm concerned, if you understand differently, just bring it up and be nice about it. But you don't have to like war against this, because I'm going to let you war on your own. This isn't a battle that I want to die over, right? So, okay, so going back over now to Daniel chapter 11, we're going to see, I also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, this is Gabriel still speaking, I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. So the angels are involved in the ministry of men. In this case, Darius, the Mede, right? So it starts out with the Medes. We see that as very clear, right? Darius is not symbolic, and the Medes are not symbolic, but it was symbolic in the past, right? In Daniel chapter 8, there was this ram that had Medes and Persians on their horns. Well, so the one came up last, which was the Persians, and you have the Medes and the Persians being referred to. Right here, we have Darius the Mede. And then it immediately goes into how there's going to be three kings that come up in Persia, right? So we have the Medes and the Persians, but they're not symbols like they were in Daniel chapter 8. It simply explains that there's a name of the king, Darius, and he's of the Medes. Okay, so we're not talking about symbols at all right here. And Gabriel is actually referring to himself being sent by God to minister to this man, Darius, who was a king. and he was a Median. Okay, he stood there to strengthen him. So angels are involved in working with those that are in God's kingdom and those that are not, right? So isn't that interesting? I think that's very interesting. So let's go back here to understand a little bit more about Daniel chapter 11. Now, will I show thee the truth? Now, this is really important where it says, I will show thee the truth. I'm going to actually highlight that one right now in that color pink. I don't know why that color shows up on my other computer. It's like a purple and I prefer that. But anyways, I will show thee the truth. Now, this is really critical to understand because what happened in Daniel chapter 7 verse 15 and onward is that I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. So he was very troubled and he needed comfort. And so when he needed comfort, what did he do? I came near to one of them that stood by and I asked him the truth of all this. Right? So one of those that stood by was an angel, and the angel was the one that was interacting with Daniel. The angel helped him to understand. In fact, so he, the angel, told me and made me to know the interpretation of the things. And notice what he said. These great beasts, which are four, you know, the four beasts that start out Daniel chapter 7, these four beasts are four kings. Okay, so the beasts, which you saw in the vision itself, are actually four kings. Okay, so now, here's what's important about this verse 16. Daniel's troubled, he needs comfort, and an angel comforts him. And so what happens is, it says that I wanted to know the truth. Wait a minute, I'm going to switch back to Daniel chapter 11 and find out, I will show thee the truth. Okay, so, whoa, wait a minute. Now, those are different words, this word here, compared to the other one in Daniel 11, because this word is Aramaic, and the other one is Hebrew. So the two different languages actually give you the different words, but they're the same kind of thought. So that's why the word truth is translated as truth. So it says, I asked him the truth, and then he told me and made me know the truth. Wait a minute, that says interpretation. Yes, that's right. So I asked him for the truth, and he gave me the interpretation. So when he gave me the interpretation, he was telling me the truth. That's really important to understand because these two words here, truth and interpretation, are synonymous. Okay, that means they mean the same thing. Even though they're different words, basically what happened is, look, would you please tell me the truth? And so he did, but he told me the interpretation of the things. And the truth of the beasts was that the beasts were four kings. Okay, so now I'm going to jump down a little bit to verse 23. And it says, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom, right? Verse 24, and the 10 horns of this kingdom are 10 kings. And so horns, it says, are kings, and the fourth beast is a kingdom. So here in Daniel chapter 7, you're actually seeing that there were symbols involved in the prophecy itself, right? So there's a prophecy, it's full of symbols, and then Daniel was like, would you please tell me the truth? I'm really troubled about this. And so the angel was like, yeah, I'll comfort you. I'll give you the interpretation. And so the interpretation comes whereby it's not any longer symbols. The symbols are explained. Please let that sink into your head. That's what's helped me understand a little bit more of how to approach Daniel chapter 11, is we're not dealing with symbols. We're dealing with Darius the Mede. Okay, it's not a beast or a horn. It's Darius. It's the actual king. And so now, minus the interpretative symbols, we're actually dealing with literal interpretation. Okay, so this is the now explanation or the truth or the interpretation of the matter. That's what's happening in Daniel chapter 11. And we're going to see the consistency from verse 2 now all the way to 45, showing that it can be literal. It can be understood literal. But remember, all roads lead to Rome, including this one. That's my understanding, because when the King of the North comes to its end, Rome will be the one that will help that to happen. And then Rome will be the one that will be consumed with the brightness of Christ's coming. And then all the prophecies fit in together. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Daniel 9, Daniel 11, Revelation 13 and 17, all roads lead to Rome. Okay, so I'm okay with that. And so if you want to lead otherwise, then fine, that's no problem. I will show thee the truth. Behold, There shall stand up yet three kings, not horns, not beasts, but kings. This is interpretive. This is the truth. In Persia. Okay, now we've already seen Medio or Media, and we've already seen Persia. This is referring to the ram in Daniel chapter 8. And it says the fourth king, that is, not the fourth beast or the fourth horn, but the fourth king shall be far richer than they all. And of course, that's Xerxes from the days of Persia. And by his strength, through his riches, shall he stir up all against the realm of that he-goat that we saw in Daniel chapter 8. The he-goat was the one that was Greece, right? So we know that the Medes and the Persians, so here's the Medes and here's the Persians and here's Greece. This is basically following the same history of Daniel chapter 8, except we are not going through symbols. We're just talking about Greece, the nation, not the he-goat. We're talking about a mighty king, which was the horn back in Daniel chapter 8, but now it's the mighty king. He shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Now, that's really interesting because this phrase comes up three different times in Daniel chapter 11, his will. So in Daniel chapter 11, verse 3, you're going to see it later in the, you know, I think like 16 or later or 20, somewhere around there. And then later in the very end of the chapter as well. I don't remember these verses off the top of my head. But this one that comes up in Greece, yeah, he does according to his will. That means there's a new king on the throne, and he's the over the realm of Greece. Yeah. So this idea of coming, according to his will, that's something that helps us know that there's a transition of these kingdoms, and we've already seen the Medes, the Persians, the Grecians, okay? And when he shall stand up, that's he being not the horn or the beast, it's the first king. That's what it says, the mighty king. His kingdom shall be broken. It's not a horn, it's not a beast, it's a kingdom that's broken. It shall be divided in the four winds of toward the four winds of heaven. That would be the east, north, west, and south. Not to his posterity, which is his, you know, family, nor according to his dominion or his strength, which he ruled, for his kingdom, not a beast, not a horn, shall be plucked up even for others besides those. And the king of the south, it's not a beast, it's not a horn, it's a king. It's the king of the south. Now, wait a minute. I want to see, where does this phrase come up in other parts of the Bible? I'm going to right-click and search for this phrase, and I'm going to see that seven different times it comes up, right? Seven times. And interestingly, every single time, and every single time only, it comes up in Daniel 11. There's one, there's two, there's three, there's four, there's five, and six, and seven. Now, we saw that five and six right here is because it was twice in one verse. And so really what's happening is, you have the king of the south, a phrase that does not occur other places other than Daniel chapter 11. Now, when I saw that, when I finally researched that, I was like, wait a minute, okay, that is kind of queer, because what happens is, you know, most of the time you're looking for a phrase in a portion of the Bible, especially in a prophecy, and you're wanting to find the meaning of it somewhere else. But we don't really have a meaning of this somewhere else, because the only time this phrase comes up is right here in this chapter. And so far we've seen it as literal, the king of the south. Now you're going to find that the phrase king of the north does the same exact thing with the same identical number, seven. I don't know why, but it's just interesting. So what we're going to see here is the king of the south shall be strong and one of his princes. It not one of his horns, not one of the beasts, but one of his princes. And the prince of the host, that is not a symbol, and so the word prince shouldn't be a symbol at all, right? He shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. No symbolism there. And in the end of the years they shall join themselves together. Join who? The beasts and the horns? Oh no. For the kings, that's who they are. The king's daughter of the south, which would be the king of the south. That's like another application to that, but it doesn't actually say king of the south. It's the king's daughter of the south. Shall come to the king of the north. Oh, another phrase here, king of the north. Let's see where this comes from. I'm going to right-click, I'm going to search for the word, and find that, yep, seven times, right there, seven times, this phrase comes up. And interestingly, it is always in Daniel 11. There's one, there's two, There's 3, there's 4, 5, 6, and 7. The last time comes up in Daniel 11:40. So that's kind of weird, because like what we're seeing is these phrases that kind of rule and dominate the theme of Daniel chapter 11, King of the South and King of the North, they both come up the same identical times, except one's like kind of worded a little bit differently, the daughter of the King of the South. And we, okay, right? So that one is like an addition, maybe like half of one. So there's 7.5 and then 7, if you will, of King of the South and King of the North. But there's 7 of them, 7 of those phrases. And they're used only in Daniel chapter 11. And so far, all the times that we've read, I mean, not just referenced, but read, we have seen that it's literal, okay? And, you know, okay, just let me take a break here. I used to teach that this section of Daniel 11, 40 and through 45 was to be interpreted as symbolic. And I had reasons for this. I had lots of reasons. In fact, I've got a whole list of reasons. But I've had to actually go through and just check those off, like, nah, not really, no, can't, no, better not, shouldn't do that. And the reason why is because I've just tried to be honest with the chapter. Like I said, I don't love the chapter, but I'm working with it, okay? I want to understand it, at least how to understand it. And so one of the major reasons why I used to be able to take this section and apply it as though it was symbolic at the end was because of Revelation chapter 6. If you know anything about the book of Revelation, there's a white horse, and then a red horse, and then a black horse, and then a pale horse, and there are souls under the altar. And these are all highly symbolic. Every portion of those seals is referred to as symbolic. But then all of a sudden, the sixth seal, the one with, you know, the great earthquake and the stars falling from heaven and the rocks and the mountains falling upon those that are crying out, whether they be kings or bondmen or slaves or servants and etc. That's not symbolic. Okay, it's comparative. If you recognize what it says, it's the earthquake comes as, it's like a tree that is shaken of a mighty wind. And the moon becomes black as sackcloth of hair. The moon becomes as blood, right? And then you have all these as references or something comparing. Instead of being symbolic, it's just a comparison of something that is like it. So these aren't symbols, okay, in Revelation chapter 6, the sixth seal. And so I used to say, see, people think it's such a problem going through Daniel chapters 1 all the way through verse 39 as literal, and then you switch to symbolic. They say, no, you can't do that. But yes, you can, because you go all the way symbolic through the fifth seals, and then you switch to comparative or somewhat literal in Revelation chapter 6. So, yeah, there seems to be a foundation for doing that. But I want to continue by saying, if we go through Daniel chapter 11 itself and just look at what's being said and look at really what's not being said, then I have concluded that we just have to take it as literal. It can't be symbolic at the end. So that's where I'm coming from, a little more for your understanding of why I'm saying what I'm saying this time. So we have the King of the North and the King of the South both coming up 7 times each, and they are both in Daniel chapter 11 only. And so now the King of the North, it's not a beast, it's not a horn, it's the King of the North. He comes to make an agreement, but she, one of the daughters, shall not retain the power of the arm. Now that arm would be, as it says here, the forces, right? The arm, the mighty power, the shoulder, the strength. So she's not going to take the power of somebody's strong arm. Neither shall he stand, which is the king that's being referred to, nor his strength or arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. But out of the branch of her roots, so like her children, if you will, the roots from her bringing forth her children, out of the branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army. Okay, this is not like locusts, as we have read, like for example in Joel chapter 2, or Revelation chapters 8 and 9, there's not these locusts that we're referring to. This is an actual army with no symbolism that's being referenced to it. And they'll enter into the fortress of the King of the North. Remember that phrase is already used here in Daniel 11. And shall deal against them and shall prevail. and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods, right? So their gods are carried captive into Egypt. Now, Egypt is not a horn or a beast. Egypt is simply a place that is stated as such. So we've already got the Medes, we've got the Persians, we've got Greece that does everything according to his will, and then now what we have here is Egypt, right? So we actually still have literal places that are being dealt with, but then there's the King of the North and the King of the South, and I think King of the South is Egypt, and the King of the North is the one that kind of changes back and forth depending on who takes over that land. I get that now, but before, I guess I understood that before as well, but that's the point. Like I said, I'm not trying to interpret necessarily. I'm just trying to look at the wording and see whether it's symbolic or not. Okay, so then we have Egypt and their gods being taken captive with their princes. These are not horns or, you know, beasts, and with their precious vessels of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Again, not a beast, not a horn, but a king. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, not a horn or a beast, and shall return into his own land. Again, this is an actual place, right? But his sons shall be stirred up. Sons are not anything symbolic. They are really his sons. They're stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. That's kind of like the strength of the arm. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Overflowing is like, if you will, like a flood or something that washes away or rinses away or runs or rushes like a river. So again, this is more comparative than symbolic, if you will. And it'll pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south, not a beast or a horn, shall be moved with anger, great choler, and shall come forth and fight with him. These are wars that are being described now, with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, and the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up. Okay, his heart shall be lifted up. We're talking about pride here. And he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. In other words, there's going to be war. He's going to be proud. He's going to cast down a lot of people, but it's not going to help him out, right? So that's just basic language about wars here. For the king of the north shall return, not the horn or the beast, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former. So now there's going to be a big army that comes, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. So he's going to be wealthy. He's going to have a great army. That's what's being described here, is just war. In those times, there shall many stand up against the king of the south. And the king here is not a beast or a horn. It's just referring to a literal king. Also, the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision. Now, many have interpreted that these are the Romans coming in, and that would make sense because the vision is the chazon, right? The chazon that we've talked about so many times, which includes the ram and the goat. And then, of course, that great horn that will come up, which represents, of course, Rome. And so if it does refer to Rome, which many have said that it does, then this vision or the chazon being the bigger picture of the vision that we'd seen before in Daniel chapter 8, it makes perfect sense. But they shall fall. Okay, they're not going to be able to, overcome at this point anyways, these Roman robbers. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities. So still wars are being described. And the arms or strength of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will. Wait a minute, we've read that before. And we read that in regard to when Greece came around. So after Greece comes who? Remember, according to the prophecy of Daniel chapter 2 with the image, and also the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, and also the beasts of Daniel chapter 8, you have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then you have Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. So Rome, of course, mixes into this religious experience in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel chapter 8. And you're probably going to find the same thing here in Daniel chapter 11, because that's what the book of Daniel is all about. It's all about, like, giving you the information and then expanding. and giving you a little bit more information, and then expanding and giving you a little bit more information, and then expanding again. And so that's what's happening in Daniel chapter 11, is we're going through the same history of Daniel 2, 7, and 8. And we can see that right here with this, the vision being fulfilled, right? And also, as it says here, this another king that does according to his own will, which would be the next king after Greece, which we know, according to the previous prophecies, is Rome. And so here, I think that Rome actually does come in. But like I said, I'm not going to be interpreting. I'm just giving you kind of like a little bit of highlight. None shall stand before him. Why? Because he's a world ruler. And he shall stand in the glorious land. Whoa, the glorious land. Now, Rome definitely did take over the glorious land. That's when Christ came here, right? Christ was here. And in the glorious land, which if you triple click this word, it means glorious and goodly or pleasant, beautiful, or even Robux. Like a Robux, really? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to right click and search for this key number to try to find a few places where it does fit into the Bible, just to see what is actually being referred to as this glorious land. So the Robux, Robux, Robux. That's kind of weird. That's how Moses used it in Deuteronomy, but then it's the beauty of Israel. Okay, so Israel is here as being referred to as beautiful, or as it refers to here in Daniel 11, glorious, right? So Israel here is being referred to as such, and again, a row in Samuel, Robux in Kings, and Chronicles is talking about rows, and so does Proverbs, and so does the Song of Solomon, and Song of Solomon again, and again, and again, and again. And then here, Isaiah talks about, in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious. Now, the branch, we know, according to Jeremiah, more specifically, is referring to Jesus Christ, right? But the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. So the branch comes out of Israel, and we know that that's Jesus Christ in its most specific application. Now, Babylon is the glory of kingdoms, and so glory here actually is talking about Babylon, not Israel. And so the Lord of hosts has purposed it to stain the pride of all glory, and that, of course, would still be the Babylonian kingdom, if I remember correctly. I went through Isaiah just not too long ago, verse by verse, but it's hard to remember all the details, and I'm not going to go into it now. So if it is something else, just understand that I've misspoken there. No ill intention. So, glory to the righteous, glory and beauty is fading like a flower. The glorious beauty, I'm going to see a couple of times here in the book of Daniel. I'm just going to skip on by now a few of them because I didn't mean to go through all of these. But in Daniel chapter 8, verse 9, it's talking about then during this time where this little horn, which became exceeding great, which was, of course, the Roman power after the Grecian power that was mentioned in verse 21 of Daniel chapter 8, you can see that this exceeding great horn, he actually went toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land, which we can understand as the glorious land, same exact word. And so that's what's happening here is this new king, which is, according to Daniel, it's the exceeding great horn in chapter 8. But here, it's this this king that does according to his will. They both enter into the glorious or pleasant lands. And that's why I wanted to look at that real quick. And also, one more time, it's referred to in Daniel chapter 11, 41. It is the glorious land. Now, if it is historically Israel here and historically Israel here, I just wonder if it would be historically Israel here in verse 41, right? So just looking, let's continue on. And it says, by his hand, the Roman hand, the glorious land will be consumed. And that's exactly what happened. And so in Daniel 11, it's just using a different phrase. Instead of pleasant land, it's glorious land. And it was consumed by his hand. Now, verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand on his side, neither for him. And this is not symbolic at all. It's just talking about how people are interacting in this whole kingdom, right? And so in verse 18, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince, not a horn or a beast, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease without his own reproach. He shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, That's just a place, a fort in his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. These are not symbolic. It actually happened during the days of Christ, in the glory of the kingdom. Oh, the glory of the kingdom. Could that potentially be the same place where Jesus was, or around that area where the taxes were raised? Well, maybe, but it's also potentially in the height of the kingdom of Rome. Whether you understand either way, it's fine with me. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And we know that that happened to the raiser of taxes, if you just go into some of the history. Now, a new paragraph here, interestingly, it says right here, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, which is actually true, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Not the horn or the beast, he's just obtaining the kingdom. These are still literal activities. With the arms of a flood, shall they be overthrown from before him. This flood is like, it's comparative, like a flood, the of a flood, not, I don't think it's necessarily symbolic, it's more comparative. It's overflown before him, and they shall be broken to pieces, or broken, yea, also the Prince of the Covenant. So the Prince of the Covenant, who's that? We've already established who that is. That's Jesus Christ. When did he show up? He was in the days of Rome. And so it makes perfect sense that this new king, who's doing according to his own will be Rome who takes over, who is a raiser of taxes and does all this stuff, including overthrowing the Prince of the Covenant, which is Jesus Christ. And he died for us. He died for all of us. And so knowing that he is in the midst of this prophecy is really why this prophecy is important. And of course, we're going to continue on trying to decipher whether or not this is symbolic or literal. And of course, this Prince of the Covenant, he is a literal person that had a literal name, the Prince of the Covenant. That's not symbolic at all. Verse 23, after the lead made with him, he shall work deceitfully, and he shall come up and shall be strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even unto the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. I mean, this is literal, right? Fathers' fathers and fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, not a horn or a beast, it's just still the king of the south. And this is where that phrase was used twice in one verse. He has a great army, not locusts, nothing symbolic. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. Again, not locusts. And he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, kind of like a flood, right? Symbolic or comparative, if you will. And sure, symbolic, but this is not a key term in the prophecies we've read before that would lead us to believe that this entire section is symbolic. And many shall fall down slain. Both these kings, not horns or beasts, hearts, shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table. In other words, they're working together to be mischievous. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return. Oh, by the way, let's see, there was a verse, here it is, even for a time. In verse 24, it seems to me that going through Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 8, when you're reading about the times, those are symbolic. So in the midst of Gabriel explaining what the symbols are, he used a symbol of time without giving some kind of interpretation. So it does seem like a time, if it's a noun like it is here, instead of something that would be like an adjective added onto something for a further purpose, it would seem in that sense it would be referring to the 360 days or prophetic years or literal years is what I meant. So just as a note, you can find in Daniel 7 and 8 that he doesn't give an interpretation for the times. He just simply makes it clear that they're something that is to be understood that would take you to the end of time. So when it says at the time appointed, this is not the same phrase, okay? The word time here is not even in the Hebrew. It's a time appointed. This is the word that's being referred to. So don't confuse this time with the one at the end of verse 24. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. So it sounds like this Roman power is starting to turn religious, right? His heart is now against God's true Holy Covenant. They've already killed the prince of the Holy Covenant. And so he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Again, this is not symbolic. He's actually doing things that are with literal terra firma. At the time appointed, again, this is not a word in the original Hebrew. This is just the time appointed, okay? So this is not to be understood in the same sense as the last word of Daniel 11:24. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south. Okay, this is not symbolic. It's actually a literal direction. But it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Shittim shall come against him. The ships are not necessarily to be understood symbolic, but you could know that these ships are either for war or for produce and substances, kind of like commerce, right? Therefore shall he be grieved in return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Now, he's really still indignant. I mean, he's already indignant before, and his heart is against the Holy Covenant. Now he's indignant against it, right? So shall he do, and he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. So now, all of a sudden, there's indignation and an alliance or an intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Now you're getting into a real war against not just kings and princes, but you're getting into a war against religion and the truth of God. And arms shall stand on his part. In other words, he's going to be strong with military force against those that are true to the Holy Covenant, but with those that forsake the Holy Covenant. And they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily. Now, the daily, this is a noun, not an adjective, so yes, I understand differently than I used to before. The daily here as a noun is not an adjective, and therefore should not be understood as it was when it was used in the sanctuary service of specifically like the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus uses that word tamid every single time in light of the holy place ministry. Yes, there is sacrifice in the outer court, but the blood is taken into the holy place, and that's where it ends up. So every single time in the book of Exodus, when the word tamid or daily, which is actually like eternal or everlasting or continual, when that word is used, it's specifically coined or brought together with the holy place ministry portion of the sanctuary service. And I think that's important because it helps us learn a little bit what the motive behind the pagan and papal systems was. You see, I did a message with you all here in Daniel chapter 8 showing that the pagan and papal systems were actually doing everything on earth to personate or symbolize what was actually happening in heaven, for the purpose of destroying those that actually wanted to uphold the Holy Covenant. They wanted to forsake the Holy Covenant, you know, the heavenly one, and make a false earthly one to try to confuse the minds of God's people and make desolate the sanctuary that should have been filled with God's people. But the information about it was severed. It was, like, hidden. It was, in fact, it was persecuted against during that time. If you actually had the Bible, which would teach you about the heavenly sanctuary, whereby you can be in heavenly places in Christ, then you could be killed, right? So it wasn't very popular to know about the truth of the heavenly sanctuary during that time, but everything on earth looked just like the heavenly sanctuary. And so all of this confusion and all of this deception came in. And that's why in Revelation 10, we are to specifically study the place where God is, that sanctuary that's in heaven. And we're to establish that in the place where it had been before. And of course, here we can see why it ended up where it was, on earth, earthly, with the priests and the high priest, and the temples and the candlestick and the incense and the bread and the wine and all those things that are actually symbolic of what God, Christ is doing in the heavenly sanctuary. We had the actual literal downhill here, which is obviously very dirty, very carnal, very contrary to the truth. And so that's what was happening. I've already talked about that before in chapter 8, so we're not going to deal with it now. But that's what was going on. And so he has come to pollute the sanctuary of strength and shall take away the daily, which is pagan. I understand that, but he looked just like what God's kingdom looks like. The word sacrifice isn't even there. And they shall place in the stead of the daily the abomination that makes desolate. And that is the pagan papal rather system. And that is looking just like what Christ is doing in the heavens. And that's where the deception comes in. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flattery. So his business is to corrupt. That's why he's here. That's why the abomination of desolation was set up, is to corrupt and look just like what happened in or is happening in heaven. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do. And that's what I want to be. I want to be a person that knows my God. There's one God, the God and Father of all. That is the Father even of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. May I be one that understands. May I be among the people, and may I instruct many that do not understand. I want to be one of those people. Yet they shall fall by the sword, and if God calls me to do that, may it be his will, and may I be faithful even during that time. Or by flame, or by captivity, or by spoil, however God wants to get rid of me, may I be faithful until he does. Now, when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. That's where the false gospel came into the true Christianity, was right there by that phrase, many shall cleave to them with flatteries. But some of them that understand or of understanding shall fall, and to try them and to purge them and make them white, even to the time of the end, and because it is yet for a time appointed. Okay, so the time, it's of. So this is an expression of something. This is not to be understood in the same way that the word the time was in Daniel chapter 11, verse 24 at the end. So it's the time of the end. We'll talk about that at verse 40, but because it is yet for a time appointed. Again, that word is not even in the Hebrew. It says there in verse 36, and the king shall, not the beast, not the horn, but the king shall do according to his will. Oh, wait a minute. There's another king that has come in. I frankly believe that this refers to France, but I'm not going to get into all the reasons why, except that he has no God, and there's only one kingdom that really messed with God's people that had no God during this time. It was around the time appointed, right? It was after Rome, and this king wants to do according to his will. So we've already seen that phrase, according to his will, and we can see that another kingdom has come in. And it says, and he will magnify himself above every god. Above every god. God, the God of heaven, the gods here on the earth, any god that is claimed, he magnifies himself above that God. Now, sure, people have applied this to the papacy, and it seems like that phrase could, but I just don't go there because of the latter portions of this explanation. He will speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and of course France did that. He shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. The indignation, that would be the 1260 days, for that is determined shall be done, which is the end of that whole system in 1798. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God. So this one right here would be hard to place in any other system other than the French. Now, for he shall magnify himself above all. Okay, so he's really thinking that he is the God of the universe, if you will, or if you will, because he magnifies himself, saying that there is no God other than himself and their own wisdom, etc. But in his state shall he honor the God of forces, okay? This is the same kind of strength and military that we talked about before. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Now, these here, friends, and by the way, this is not the same word as the pleasant that we looked at before, like the pleasant land or the glorious land, but nothing here is symbolic. Verse 39, thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. Like, do yourself the favor of studying this yourself. I'm not going to get into all the interpretations, but it is not symbolic. These are actual, just historic facts, not dealing with horns, or locusts, or beasts, or those kind of things. Verse 40, and at the time of the end, which again is the time of the end, not to be understood as the time or a time, time and a dividing a time, but the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him. Now, this is not a horn. It is not a beast. There's no reason to take this king of the south, as it's been used previously in this chapter, and use it now as symbolic. I can't find a reason why, but he will gore or push at him. And so he's going to thrust himself at him. The king of the north, again, it's not a beast or a horn. It's a king of the north, one of the seven times it's used, and it's just used in the same kind of way. Literal, as far as I can tell. Will come against him like. This is like a whirlwind. It is not symbolic, it's comparative. With chariots and horsemen and with many ships, chariots can be symbolic of angels, but I can't imagine that this section is dealing with the wars that are being dealt with, dealing specifically here as symbolic as angels. You can just find that, for example, in Psalm 68, verse 17. So it says, with horsemen and with ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So, I mean, maybe angels are referred to here as symbolic, but that wouldn't change the idea of kings. You know, like the word king sometimes being beast or horns. That word chariot, if it did refer to horses, wouldn't change everything here to make the whole thing symbolic. So I'm just saying. Verse 41, he shall enter also into the glorious land. Now remember, we've already looked at this, and it happens in Daniel chapter 8 as the pleasant land, and the one that was doing harm in the glorious land back time, that time, which was Rome, was actually... maybe I misspoke earlier, I'm not sure, but I don't think this is Rome necessarily. Let me just clarify that. But the point is that they're entering into that land together, and there's no symbolism here. He being not a horn or a beast, but a king. It's the king, as it says, that's being described here, right there. King of the north, right? He enters into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. Now, not horns or beasts, this is actually a word supplied, but many will be overthrown. Many what? Many other kings or countries. But these shall escape out of his hand. Edom, Moab, the chief of the children of Ammon. Okay, so yes, you could understand that in a sense from Isaiah, this could refer to a group of people, but these are still literal lands here that are being referred to. Verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries. Not beasts, not horns. These are countries. And the land of Egypt, another country that's not symbolic. Because, like, for example, if you went to, Dragon, Egypt. If you went and looked up that, you'd find that in Ezekiel 29, verse 3, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is referred to as the great dragon. So if it was symbolic in Daniel chapter 11, it wouldn't call it Egypt, it would call it the great dragon, right? So I just find that here, when we're talking about the land of Egypt, it's not the land of the great dragon. It shall not escape, okay? So the king of the north will come, and the land of Egypt, which we've understood as the land of the south, or the king of the south, will not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver. Gold and silver is not symbolic. And over all the precious things of Egypt. Again, another literal location. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. These are not symbolic. Those are actual places. And of course, they represent something than they used to now. But they are still not symbolic. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Now, wait a minute. Let's go and find this word here, east, in the book of Daniel. I'm going to go and just do a little tiny thing here, which is I'm going to add a specific setting, I guess, to this. I'm going to study in the book of Daniel, and I'm going to find that the word east only comes up twice. And just like we had seen where the little horn before had gone into the pleasant land, right here as it says, he had also gone into the east, and it wasn't symbolic. He actually went to the south, he went to the east, and he went toward the pleasant land. And so this little horn here, he did that which was actual. And here, tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Now, why would it be symbolic here if it's not here, right? So it just seems like even in this symbolic section, it's not symbolic. But here in what seems to be a literal section, it shouldn't be symbolic either. And it just seems to make sense to me anyways. So tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, because of that, those tidings, he shall go forth with great fury and destroy and utterly make away many. Nothing here needs to be symbolic in this section. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Now, I'm going to go ahead and find where else this phrase, glorious holy mountain, occurs. Search for this specific phrase, and it only comes up in Daniel chapter 11, verse 45. Kind of like the king of the south and the king of the north, this phrase, the whole of it, only comes up one time. Now, if I went and found the phrase holy mountain, and I were able to look at it, I would search for that phrase and find that it comes up actually 16 different times. I'll show you right there. And the first time, it is, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. This is God speaking, and it's God's mountain. Even them will I bring to my holy mountain in Isaiah 56, and it is God's mountain there again. That would be Zion, right? And in verse 13 of 57, that those that trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. This is again God's holy mountain. They will forget God's holy mountain. This is the Lord speaking again. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. They won't destroy in all of my holy mountain. Again, this is God's place. So Isaiah 66:20, the swift beasts will be, let's see, in my holy mountain, Jerusalem. And so the holy mountain is specifically Jerusalem, because that's, you know, Mount Zion is the holy mountain, but Jerusalem is there on Mount Zion, and that's why Mount Zion is referred to, is not because it's a mountain, but because of Jerusalem being there. And so in my holy mountain, in the mountain of the height of Israel, so Israel is where the holy mountain is, and upon the holy mountain is Jerusalem, and that's why it's being focused on. So I'm just going to scroll down and go into Daniel, and we're going to see that the holy mountain is referred to here in Daniel 9, verse 16. O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from the city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain. So Jerusalem is actually referred to as thy holy mountain, which is God's holy mountain, in prayer is what Daniel is saying this. Jerusalem is the holy mountain. Okay, so Jerusalem is not symbolic. The holy mountain isn't symbolic. It's actually God's holy mountain. And there's no reason to understand it as symbolic. It's either in heaven or on earth, depending on which one, right? And so in verse 20, it's saying that he was presenting his supplication before the Lord his God for the holy mountain, which is, again, in Israel, and it is in Jerusalem, and it has that temple in it. But it says here, verse 45, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace. Remember, he being an actual king, not a beast, not a horn, he's going to plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas. Now, the seas, should we, in this section of Daniel 11, understand these seas to be symbolic? Well, he is not symbolic. The tabernacles of his palace is not symbolic. The holy mountain is not symbolic. Why should we then say that this represents peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues? It would therefore represent the two oceans in the glorious holy mountain that are next to it, between the seas of the where the glorious holy mountain is. And of course, that would be the two seas that you can see there, the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean, right? So between the two seas of the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end. So whoever this king of the north is, whoever you would like to apply it to, he's going to come to his end. And if in fact the Babylonian power at the end of time, which we could say is Roman, because it's, you know, the Roman Catholic system that has its place in Revelation chapter 13, connected with the apostate Protestants here in America, if they have any way to bring this power to its end, then of course this prophecy, just like all the others, ends in Rome. All roads lead to Rome. So now, none is going to help him, but that's not symbolic either, right? We've gone through what I think is, to me anyways, a very descriptive and conclusive way of looking at this section, proving to me, to my eyes, whether it's yours or not, it doesn't matter to me. If you want to understand this differently, go for it. I encourage you. Just keep studying. That's really the whole goal of this section, is just so that you can see how I've been able to study and have been able to understand that this is all literal, all of it. And it would therefore mean literal kings, literal places, literal people, literal attacks, literal wars, literal seas, literal palaces, literal God's place on earth, which used to be, of course, during Daniel's day, Jerusalem, which I know is not now. But anyways, we can see that those that prophecy to me would best be applied in the literal sense. Now, if I am wrong, I pray that God will help me to understand better. But so far, after many, many years of going through this, this is where I've concluded at this point. So if you feel like I'm wrong and you really think I should understand differently, please pray for me instead of throwing stones at me. I'd appreciate that. So what matters here is that we have the Prince of the Covenant that was actually attacked and killed by all the demons in this world. On the cross, Jesus Christ died for you and me. And that's what matters. That's really what matters, is that in Daniel chapter 12, that same Christ that was crucified was resurrected by his Father and will stand up in chapter 12. When he stands up, I want to be prepared for that time where the final judgment, the judgment is closed and the final opportunities for God's people to repent has finished. When he stands up, I want to be ready. That's what matters to me. Whether that includes knowing the details of the King of the North and the King of the South, I'm not sure. But I want my character to be right, okay? And so if I disagree with somebody, I want to treat them as a Christian. And that's what I want from you too. So may it be that we submit ourselves to God, to his Son, to the ministration of his Spirit through his ministers, which are angels, and may we all work together to be able to proclaim the truth to as many as far and as wide as possible. Let's pray together and commit ourselves to that end. Our Father in heaven, I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to look at Daniel chapter 11 and why I've concluded that it should be understood as literal instead of symbolic. I pray that you'd help us to understand whatever you'd have us to, and to be unified in spirit, wanting to know the truth, whether we disagree or not. Help us to just be kind and wanting to push forward to understand what is true and what is not, without becoming angry and frustrated with each other. Thank you for this, and we ask that you would lead and guide that as we continue to live the life that you've called us to, that we will be prepared for that time where your son, Michael, stands up and the judgment is complete here in that phase of the judgment. We pray that you would please prepare us for that time. May our families and friends and all of us be ready for that. And we look forward to the day when Christ will come after he stands. Thank you so much. In his name, amen.
I guess I'll say it's very deep. Maybe from your sharing, from a personal level, I like to read chapter 11 afresh. With that, to try and figure out what that means.
Yes, Pastor, as you have said, there is no place where Gabriel changes his explanation and makes it symbolic. In fact, the beginning of the chapter where he talks about, in verse 2, where he says, "And now will I show thee the truth." It means that the manner in which he's explaining things is very literal, because he's talking about kingdoms, he's talking about kings and real people in real places. As far as the narrative goes, it doesn't change anywhere. There's no turn of phrase where now he begins to say, now this represents that. No, it is just literal kings, places where those things happen. But also, something very interesting, Pastor, that I really like us to consider is why we need to understand this prophecy as literal. A lot of what the prophecy does are very secretive. The prophecy doesn't do everything in the open. I believe all of us know, for example, what it's doing with climate change. These are things that didn't come up at the time they were announced. A lot of them happened way in the background. And so I believe that Daniel chapter 11 is a literal prophecy that God gives us. So Daniel gets this explanation from Gabriel, so that in the end time, God's people will be able to see literal things to help them understand things that are happening in the background, because the prophecy won't do everything in the open. And it's very important that God does that for his people, so that even as we watch the prophecy, we will not know everything that the prophecies do. But with this literal prophecy, we will be able to have an understanding of time, how time is running. And this is very important, especially in verse 45, because the very next thing after the king of the north plants his tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, the very next thing is Christ coming.